And here, referring to the Temple of Set, resuming with the article, admittedly, it seems startling that a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, who is also a doctor of political science holding a top secret clearance, is the high priest of a leading religious satanic group in America. But like many other revelations encountered during this research, it is true. There seems to be a common thread in the allegations against the cults: themes of personal power and control over others, the use of cameras, domination over society, mind control techniques, and in some cases, even blood terrorism. I think our statement of what we're really driving at here behind these satanic cults is summed up neatly in this particular sentence. I'll repeat it. There seems to be a common thread in the allegations against the cults: themes of personal power and control over others, the use of cameras, domination over society, mind control techniques, and in some cases, even blood terrorism. It is possible that the motives range from individual power needs to drug-induced psychoses, to these cults actually being simple fronts for high-level drug dealers, traffickers in kiddie porn, child prostitution, and snuff films. Some conspiracy buffs even suggest that the cults are KGB-supported. And while this seems totally insane, we are reminded of one sobering fact. A year ago, high-level officials of a behavioral science unit of the FBI in Quantico, Virginia, thought cults were a laughing matter. Now, members of that same unit are taking it seriously enough to hold conferences and mount investigations into the subject. Jean-Paul Sartre once said that the difference between Europeans and Americans is that Americans don't really believe in the existence of evil. That may soon change. Indeed.
And we have one more short segment, I believe, do we not, from the same article that we want to...
Page 50.
There we go. And very short segment, which will lead into the next section of our broadcast. I should just say, speaking of that, at this point, I should make a brief announcement. Continuing, again, a short segment here from the same article, that being The Devil Made Me Do It, from Penthouse Magazine, as previously discussed by Dr. Joel Norris and Jerry Allen Potter. Short segment, it's going to lead us into our next portion of the broadcast. In Atlanta, and this is again, mind you, is dated 1986. In Atlanta, ritualistic killings of black children do not appear to have stopped, even after the arrest and conviction of Wayne Williams. 20 black children have been killed in a similar manner since his arrest. We are going to, with very little ado, get into that in just a second, as soon as we get this tape cartridge put in and Dave gets a chance to introduce it to you.
Yeah, basically, we're going to dip back into our archives once again, and we're going to take a look now at the murders of blacks, specifically the Atlanta child murders, what we referred to in an early, early One Step Beyond show as Das Schwarzenacht, playing off Das Kristallnacht, when many Jews were killed and their shops trashed in Weimar, Germany. There was a wave of killings of black people in 1980 and 81, and there are certain indications that this may have come from elements of the far right in conjunction with elements of the national security establishment, and the possibility here that cults, and specifically satanic cults of a Nazi bent, may have been used for this purpose is what we're going to speculate about now. We're going to take a look now at a Hard Rain show. We're going to listen to, I should say, a Hard Rain show from a number of years ago. Specifically, let me get the date on this.
January 25th, 1981, I believe.
Sure. Yep, that's it. This is January 25th, 1981, and this is an excerpt from an old Hard Rain show. That's a show that I used to do, originally over on KKUP and also here. Similar in content and form to what we're doing here, it's just that originally we used to do One Step Beyond, and then we'd have Hard Rain, and then it just became too much work to produce all those shows, so we'd lump it into one, and so now we have One Step Beyond and Radio Free America. So we have one, combined the two shows into one, and we have the monthly archive show. And Hard Rain now belongs exclusively to the archives. However, once in a while we drag one out here and then go into the past. Here again, we're going to be taking a look at the murders of blacks in 80 and 81. And this again in the context of these satanic cults as basically fronts for espionage and Nazi activity. In this case, the spreading of this particular form of terrorism. So here is Hard Rain from January 25th of 1981. Well, the news media have given a great deal of coverage to the series of murders and disappearances of black children in and around Atlanta, Georgia. There are a number of aspects to the case which have not received that much publicity, though, and I'm going to review some of those for you right now and for the duration of the broadcast. For a while, the investigators in Atlanta were focusing on a house which had a number of suspicious things about it, and
A story about this suspicious house was carried in the San Jose Mercury News on January 4th of 1981. The following is a UPI story out of Atlanta, and it's headlined, House May Hold Clues to Victims. An abandoned house that smelled like decaying flesh, unquote, and contained shovels, an axe, and a hatchet was found Saturday by volunteers searching for clues in the slayings and disappearances of 15 Atlanta children. One searcher said neighbors had reported seeing a black man and a black child using the house about 2 months ago. The owner of the house, David Westbrook, said he rented out the house but did not know where the tenants were. He said the tenants left behind their possessions. Atlanta Police Chief George Knapper, N-A-P-P-E-R, said police would check the house thoroughly for possible clues or bodies. The house was brought to the attention of volunteer searcher Catherine Whetstone in the Adamsville section south of southwest Atlanta by a teenager who said he had seen a pickup truck outside the house every night. Two rooms smelled like decaying flesh, and one had several mattresses in it, said Whetstone, who said she recognized the odor as being similar to the odor she smelled when she and other searchers found the decomposed remains of 7-year-old LaTanya Wilson in a wooded lot in October. In one area of the house, she said, two Bibles were nailed to a wall. The Bible was open to Isaiah, chapter 2 and chapter 3. It was about mixing blood and murders, said Whetstone said. The searchers found two shovels, one near a pile of bricks in front of a fireplace in the rear of the house. After removing the bricks, Whetstone said she found a hole 10 to 15 feet deep. When we looked down into it, all we could see was red dirt, unquote, she said. Besides the shovels, an axe and a hatchet, other items found in the house included several bicycles for both adults and children, furniture, and clothing. I don't know what to make of it, said John Bascom, a search organizer. We've turned things over to police. Well, there are a couple of interesting things about this article. Obviously, there were some suspicious things about the house, not just the decaying flesh odor, but also the many children's items, plus the tools, the hole that was found there, the reports of a pickup truck being parked outside the house every night. And I was particularly struck by the passages here from the Bible, Isaiah chapter 2 and chapter 3. I don't know exactly what this mixing blood refers to, whether they're talking about stirring blood up in a bowl, whether they're talking about mixing blood with murder, or whether they're talking about mixing blood as in race mixing, which, of course, is one of the Nazis' pet peeves, I guess you might say. So that remains to be seen. However, apparently, none of these clues turned out into any harder evidence, and the lead was abandoned. That was carried in an article which appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Tuesday, January 1st of 1981. Following is a UPI story out of Atlanta, and it's headlined, No Murder Clues in Atlanta House. An abandoned house where searchers found children's clothing, axes, shovels, and two Bibles nailed open to a wall was ruled out yesterday as a link to the mystery of 15 slain or missing black children. Two investigators, along with Philadelphia tracker Don Lacken, L-A-K-E-N, took a second look at the southwest Atlanta house but found nothing, and one investigator said the house was ruled out, unquote, as important to the case. A spokesman for the Special Police Task Force investigating the case said the clothing and most of the other items had been accounted for, unquote, by caretakers of the house and were not related to the deaths and disappearances of the 15 children. Police did, however, send several unaccounted for items, including the two Bibles, to a crime lab for fingerprint checks. The Bibles were open to passages from Isaiah 1:14 to 3:25 and Jeremiah 15:4 to 18:4, that made frequent references to children and death. Although one volunteer who helped police search the area Saturday said the house smelled like decaying flesh, unquote, there was no such scent yesterday. Since July 19th, 11 black children from low-income areas of Atlanta have been found dead, and four others are missing. All the children were between ages 7 and 15. Well, interestingly enough, the passages here, I don't know if it's significant or not, but the passages quoted here, Isaiah 1:14 to 3:25 and Jeremiah 15:4 to 18:4, are not the same passages that were quoted in the first article I read you from the San Jose Mercury News a couple of days previous. That article referred to the chapters as being Isaiah chapter 2 and 3, so I don't know which article is correct. I do find the biblical passages interesting, though. Of course, there are a lot of people these days standing on the Bible in order to preach hatred, and one wonders perhaps if the odor of decaying flesh around this house had anything to do with the moral majority. few days after the last article I read you appeared, another black child disappeared in Atlanta. The following story appeared in the San Jose Mercury News on Thursday, January 8th of 1981. This is a UPI story out of Atlanta, and it's headlined, Vanished Atlanta Teen is Number 16 in Slaying and Disappearance Series. The disappearance of a 14-year-old boy last weekend was turned over to a 35-member special police task force Wednesday, bringing to 16 the number of black children who have been slain or vanished in Atlanta over the past 17 months. Public Safety Commissioner Lee Brown told a news conference that the case of 14-year-old Luby Chuck Jeter fits the characteristics of the other missing children, but more important, he has no history of running away, unquote. The task force has been investigating the slaying of 11 children and the disappearance of four more over the past 18 months. All were black, all were from low-income families, all between the ages of 7 and 15 years, and all but two have been boys. Well, the article goes on to describe some more about the search itself. There is no terribly significant information there. The day after this article appeared, they turned up the skeletons, who were positively identified as two of the missing black children. And interestingly enough, apparently the police officers who found the skeletons were, well, messing around with the skeletons. The coroner chastised them very severely for having interfered with the investigation. That information was carried in a story which appeared in the San Jose Mercury News on Monday, January 12th of 1981, 3 days after the children were found and 4 days after the 16th disappeared. Following is an AP story out of Atlanta, headlined, Inquiry Hindered, Coroner Says. Law enforcement officers hindered a coroner's inquiry by disturbing skeletal remains found last week in the investigation of the killings or disappearances of 16 black children, the Fulton County Medical Examiner said Sunday. Dr. Robert Stivers said he was considering filing charges Monday against federal, state, and local law enforcement officers because they moved the bones without permission from his office. They disturbed it, and that's a violation of the law, unquote, he said in a telephone interview. It slowed us down considerably. Stivers said when his investigator arrived on the scene where the two skeletons were found Friday, there was an FBI agent and members of the state crime lab picking up bones and putting them in a sack. We didn't have a crime scene to look at, unquote. The offense is a misdemeanor that could carry a maximum penalty of 1 year in prison and a $1,000 fine. Meanwhile, Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner Lee P. Brown said in an interview with ABC News that police had noted similarities between the child death cases here and a case in New Jersey in which a 22-year-old drifter was arrested in connection with the slaying of a black child. Brown said the man was not designated as a major suspect in the Atlanta slayings. Well, that's the first report I have heard about the New Jersey case. Interestingly enough, that murder was attributed to a drifter. The reports from Atlanta and Buffalo talk about somebody who is believed to be a Skid Row drifter. Don't know if there's any relation or whatever, but I do think it's important to note the case in New Jersey. I wonder how many other places black children are disappearing or turning up dead. Well, an interesting story appeared in the San Francisco Examiner on Wednesday, December 31st of 1980. That, of course, was New Year's Eve. This concerns charges by an Atlanta pastor that the police were harassing and surveilling him because he had organized a group to investigate the disappearance and slayings of the children. As I said, once again, this is from the San Francisco Examiner on Wednesday, December 31st of 1980. It's a UPI story out of Atlanta, and it's headlined, Atlanta Pastors Sues Harassers, unquote. The head of a committee concerned with the cases of 15 missing and dead children has filed a $1 million federal court suit accusing Mayor Maynard Jackson and Atlanta police with harassment. The Reverend Earl Carroll, founder of the Committee to Stop Children's Murders, said in the suit filed yesterday that Jackson and police officials violate his civil rights to privacy and liberty by keeping him under constant surveillance. He says it amounts to a form of arrest, unquote. Carroll, 45, a self-styled born-again Christian with no formal ministerial background, said he is being harassed by police officials because he brought the case to the public eye before officials were willing to admit that there was a problem. The associate pastor of the Wheat Street Baptist Church said in the suit that 12 policemen working 3 8-hour shifts with teams of 4 people have kept him under surveillance since about September 12th. Police officials refused to comment on why Carroll was being followed. Meanwhile, tracker Don Lackens, trained German shepherds who were given scents from clothing belonging to four children still missing, have found several items in the last 2 days and that Lacken believes could be linked to the cases. The items, a knife, a rock splashed with a red substance, and bits of tiles were found near Lincoln Cemetery Monday and yesterday. The knife and rock were turned over to police for analysis along with two sticks that looked like pegs or stakes and two pieces of white tile that the dog seemed particularly interested in, Lacken said. Although authorities say the two items weren't related to the cases, the dogs have returned to the area several times. In addition, city excavation equipment was sent to the cemetery this week after a black child's shoe was found. That cemetery being the Lincoln Cemetery, where a psychic had said some material might be found. Well, I don't know just what that means. I don't know anything about Reverend Earl Carroll, whether that might conceivably be related to the Bibles that were found in the houses, whether maybe that the police were suspicious of such a link and that's why they were following him. But who knows? It's something certainly to bear in mind. Well, on Saturday, January 17th of 1981, there was another development in the case. The San Francisco Examiner reported that two suspects had been picked up and released by the Atlanta police in connection with the case. Interesting enough, they only allude to one suspect here. I suspect the editor who was responsible for generating this article, or editing this article, I really should say, did not read it very carefully, because actually they talk about two suspects here. Once again, this is from the San Francisco Examiner on Saturday, January 17th of 1981. This is a UPI story out of Atlanta, headlined, Atlanta Checks Kidnapped Suspect. Police are trying to determine today whether a man charged earlier this week with the attempted kidnapping of a 5-year-old black girl is connected to the slayings and disappearances of 16 Atlanta black children. Police arrested Jeffrey Dwayne Scott, 19, of Atlanta Thursday after he was seen allegedly picking up the screaming child and carrying her in his arms. The guy saw me coming and panicked, said witness Willie Clayton. He put the girl down and took off, unquote. Only two of the 16 victims, 12 dead and 4 still missing, were girls. Atlanta police were also investigating a rash of reported kidnappings yesterday, but apparently none of them was confirmed. One reportedly turned out to be a hoax, but at least two other attempted kidnapping cases were being investigated. Earlier yesterday, another man, who police said was impersonating a police officer and had lollipops and a fake badge in his car, was questioned in connection with the children's cases, but later was ruled out as a suspect. Police earlier had noted the candy and badge could have been used to lure children. The red-bearded young man, whose name was not released, was arrested on marijuana possession and traffic charges. Police said he had been spotted a day earlier driving a blue car with a blue flashing light and a siren. He was pursued then and eluded capture, but officers spotted him again yesterday and caught him. Later yesterday, Roger Harris, a spokesman for the Police Public Affairs Division, said the man is no longer considered a suspect, unquote. There has been considerable speculation in the black community that the killer may be posing as a policeman to lure the children into the car. So once again, take note of the suspect who was seen attempting to abduct a black girl. He was released, and also the fellow with a fake badge, the bag of lollipops, who was driving a blue car with a flashing light and a siren, he also was released. 6 days after that story appeared, another article appeared in the San Francisco Examiner, this from Friday, January 23rd of 1981. This concerns the 17th in the series of slayings and disappearances, and this was a black child whose body was found in a suburb of Atlanta. And interestingly enough, the police had been tipped off that a clue would appear linking Rockland County, Georgia, to the Atlanta slayings, and yet they regarded the phone call as a prank. This story, as I say, was in the Examiner on Friday, January 23rd. This is an AP story out of Conyers, Georgia, entitled, Body of a Black Child Discovered in Atlanta Suburb. The body of a black child was found this morning in a suburban woods near an interstate highway, Rockdale County Sheriff Victor Davis said. Officers of a task force investigating the mysterious slayings and disappearances of black children in Atlanta were sent to the scene. A sheriff's investigator, Wendell Whitmore, said the victim appeared to be about 13 or 14 years old. Davis said the body was found at about 7:30 a.m. alongside Sigmund Road, south of Interstate 20, about 25 miles east of downtown Atlanta. Atlanta police have been stymied by the deaths and disappearances of 16 black children since July 1979. The children range in age from 7 to 15. This, by the way, would be the 17th. 2 weeks ago, the woods at Stigman Road were searched by Rockdale County officers who said an anonymous caller had provided a tip that evidence in the child killings would be found in the area. The search turned up no clues, police said. The body was spotted by an electrician, Mike Abbott, who was driving to work from his house about 500 yards away. There was no way you could miss him, Abbott said. This guy seemed to be neatly placed on his left side, unquote. Abbott said he got out of his truck to make sure the child, who was neatly dressed with his shirt tucked in, was not hurt. When I went over to him, it didn't dawn on me that he was dead, unquote, Abbott said. But the boy didn't respond to a shout, and when Abbott shook him, the body was stiff. He immediately called police. Abbott said sheriff's deputies had visited the homes in the neighborhood 2 weeks ago and left a leaflet warning that an anonymous telephone call had promised a link between Rockdale County and the Atlanta child killings. After a thorough investigation, we have no reason to believe that this was anything other than a prank call, unquote, said the leaflet, signed by Sheriff Davis. Where our children are concerned, we can't be too careful. Therefore, we urge all of you to use extra precautions in keeping up with the whereabouts of your children, and do not let them go anywhere alone. We are increasing the patrol in your neighborhood, and if you need us, don't hesitate to call, unquote. The residents of the suburban subdivisions near the site where the body was found today are predominantly white. Well, this concludes our examination of some aspects of the cases in Buffalo and New York City and Atlanta that have been somewhat overshadowed by other news events. Next week, we're going to discuss other racial attacks or other racial killings, particularly here in the Bay Area, and well, we'll speculate about a few other aspects of those. We're going to take a short musical break and then play some part of another Hard Rain broadcast. Okay, well, we're going to go directly from that discussion of the Atlanta child murders, and we're going to take a look now at a case called the Darlin June Cromer case. Due to limitations of time, we're not going to go into the material about the control of Candy Jones. Suffice it to say that in Radio Free America number 6, we went into in considerable detail the CIA's practice, at least as practiced on Candy Jones and others, of deliberately inculcating race hatred, essentially a Nazi worldview, in experimental subjects in the CIA. Again, this might sound sort of fantastic to people that are not familiar with the archives, but in Radio Free America number 6, played a couple of months ago on sister station KKUP, we went into the Candy Jones material. That material, by the way, comes from a book called The Control of Candy Jones, authored by Donald Bain, put out by the Playboy Press, copyright 1976. And in it, it contains some very compelling indications that, in fact, elements of CIA have been using the mind control programs, MKUltra and others, to, among other things, inculcate U.S. intelligence functionaries with a doctrinaire Nazi-like racism. And it's against this background and the background of the Atlanta child murders, and again, we're speculating about the possible use of satanic cults to spread a particular form of terrorism here, that we're going to be examining. Well, it's against the background of Candy Jones that we're going to be examining Darlin June Cromer. In a nutshell, the Atlanta child murders had a couple of interesting overtones to them. There was a lot of speculation about the effect of the Atlanta child murders on black perceptions in and around Atlanta of the effectiveness of black political leadership, because they occurred in considerable measure under the auspices of black leaders. Andrew Young, and before that, I've forgotten who was mayor just before Young, but at any rate, there was a black mayor and a fairly well-known one in Atlanta at the time, and many people thought that among the effects of the Atlanta child murder was to demonstrate to black people that black leadership wouldn't necessarily protect them from murderous escapades on the part of what people at the time viewed as probable Ku Klux Klan or Nazi activity. Which brings us to a second aspect of the Atlanta child murders. There was fear on the part of Atlanta safety officials that outrage in the black community about the killings would eventually provoke racial unrest, specifically race riots. And there was speculation that perhaps black people, again, blaming the killings on Ku Klux Klan or Nazis, would engage in race rioting on a large scale, and there was speculation that this in turn would play into the hands of the far right, as traditionally the spectacle of race riots on television works to the advantage of the far right in this country. At any rate, to the Darlin June Cromer case in 1981, and indications that this may have had cult connections as well. This is the Hard Rain program from February 2nd of 1981. At the top of the broadcast, the case of Darlin June Cromer, and there are a number of different aspects of the Darlin June Cromer case which are similar not only to the hypno-programming of Candy Jones, but which bear a couple of similarities to racial killings in Atlanta, Georgia, and Buffalo, New York. A number of the racist views that were drilled into Candy Jones under the CIA's mind control program are very similar to some of the racist attitudes that were voiced by Darlin June Cromer during the course of her trial. And in addition, there's a kind of a one-dimensional, shallow quality to the racist views expressed by Candy Jones, and in fact to all of her dialogue that is conducted in the hypnotic sessions. I don't know how evident that was during the small passage that I read you there, but that one-dimensional, shallow quality that was characteristic of the hypno-programmed parts of Candy Jones' personality was also very characteristic of the dialogue, such as all of the dialogue that was included, that was voiced by Darlin June Cromer during the course of her trial. So pay close attention to the information I'm going to present here and see if that comes out. An article which appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Tuesday, December 2nd of 1980. This was an article pertaining to the Darlin June Cromer case. It contained some similarities to the Atlanta child murder cases. Of course, the murder of Reginald Williams, a young black boy, is similar to the deaths of 20 black children in Atlanta. And in addition, apparently Darlin June Cromer had tried to abduct several other black children as well. Once again, this story is from the San Francisco Chronicle on Tuesday, December 2nd of 1980. It's an Examiner story by Anne Bancroft, and it's titled, Three Children Testify at Murder Trial. Three nervous and solemn black children took the witness stand in Alameda County Superior Court yesterday and testified that white defendant Darlin June Cromer, charged with the kidnap murder of 5-year-old Reginald Williams last February 5th, tried to entice them into her car on February 4th and 5th. 10-year-old Stephen Willis of San Francisco said he was walking to Redding Elementary School on the morning of February 4th when a white lady, unquote, pulled up in a Volkswagen and asked him if he wanted a ride to school. The boy said that the woman frightened him because she looked right through me, unquote, and because he had been told not to accept rides from strangers. When he refused, Willis said, she pulled me in, she just grasped me and pushed me into the back seat. After the car passed his school and stopped at an intersection, Willis jumped out and ran several blocks to school where he told a teacher what had happened. Do you see that white lady anywhere in this courtroom? Asked Deputy District Attorney Albert Mullaling. Yes, said Willis. He pointed to Cromer, dressed in a pale green smock dress, who slouched in a chair with her head in her hands. Still later in the article. Yesterday, after Stephen Willis's testimony, two West Oakland girls told the jury that on February 5th, Cromer, looking weird, unquote, with painted bare feet, approached them in a grocery store near their elementary school and told them their godmother had asked her to give them a ride to their father's house. Lakeitha Parker, a tiny 7-year-old, said that the woman frightened her because she was looking at us in a funny way, unquote. She and her girlfriend, 9-year-old Felicia Bonner, felt something was wrong and refused to go with Cromer because we ain't sisters and we don't have the same father, she said. Bonner, nervously kicking her feet, which did not reach the floor of the witness stand, described how she and her schoolmate ran to school in tears after the encounter. Two school officials brought the girls back to the neighborhood of the grocery store that morning, they testified, and there they saw Cromer standing outside her Volkswagen, folding up blankets and putting them into the back seat of her car. A school aide jotted down the license number of the Volkswagen and gave it to police. That afternoon in Alameda, Reginald Williams disappeared after playing in a grocery cart at the housing project where he lived with his mother, Laura Jefferson. Later that evening, Cromer was arrested at her home in Pinole, and the next day, she led police to a shallow grave on the edge of San Pablo Bay, where Reginald Williams' body was found. In an article which appeared 2 days after the one I just read you, the testimony of a deputy sheriff was given, which indicated that Darlin June Cromer regarded blacks as less than human and felt they should be eaten like chickens and cows. In addition, she said that she wanted to join the Ku Klux Klan, and she also felt that whites must prevent blacks from reproducing. Now, as you listen to this, bear in mind the association of diet with racism in Candy Jones' hypno-programming, and bear in mind also the fact that Candy was taught that blacks should be sterilized to keep them from taking over. The following story appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Thursday, December 4th of 1980. It's
a Chronicle story by Peter Kuehl, K-U-E-H-L, and it's entitled Tale of Racial Hate in Bay Murder Trial. I'm not going to read you the whole article here, but just part of it. Deputy Dorothy Soto said Cromer wanted to talk about niggers, unquote, and even though Soto didn't encourage her, began a long, rambling diatribe against blacks. Soto, who wrote it all down later, read her recollections to the jury yesterday. She said Cromer sat on a table, talking lucidly. It is the duty of every white woman to kill a nigger child, Soto quoted Cromer. I've already killed mine. She said Cromer urged her to kill a black child herself. Cromer said she wanted to eat a nigger more than a chicken or a cow, unquote, the deputy testified. During cross-examination by the defense, Soto said Cromer had said nothing about trying to eat the victim. Cromer told Soto, the deputy said, that if I get out of this, she planned to join the Ku Klux Klan. Still later, Soto said Cromer told her she had trouble killing Reginald, whom she took behind a building and strangled to death. Cromer then drove to San Francisco to visit a boyfriend in San Francisco General Hospital. A psychiatric technician at the hospital had earlier testified that Cromer seemed upset during her visit there and kept calling black hospital workers niggers, unquote, as she paced about phonetically. Soto said Cromer always referred to the victim as it, unquote. And material similar to the material I just presented you was contained in an article which appeared in the San Francisco Examiner on Friday, December 19th of 1980. And I'm not going to read you this, all of this article either. Just part of it. It's an Examiner story by Don Martinez, and it's entitled, Psychiatrist Denies Cromer's Racism in Court. She's sick, unquote. This refers to the testimony of a psychiatrist named Dr. Donald Lund, L-U-N-D-E, who is from Stanford University, just down the road here. The article reads, the psychiatrist referred to Cromer's obsession to eat black people for several years before she killed the toddler. She didn't want anybody to know where the child was, Dr. Lund said, because she was going to eat the body. That's what she told me. Still later. However, Alameda County Deputy District Attorney Albert Mullaling said that Cromer mentioned to jailers that, once I'm out, I'm going to the South and learn all about that, all about the Ku Klux Klan and all that racist stuff, unquote. Additionally, Mullaling said that Cromer told another jailer that, quote, everybody thinks I'm crazy, but I planned this, referring to the boy's murder, unquote. Some more interesting material on the Darlin June Cromer case came to light in an article which appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle on Friday, December 12th of 1980. This is a Chronicle story entitled, A Jail Psychologist Testifies in Trial of Alameda Black Child Slayer. The first paragraph here reads as follows. When Darlin June Cromer strangled 5-year-old Reginald Williams February 5th, she thought the killing of the black child from Alameda would cause a snowball effect in reaction to blacks taking over, unquote, a psychologist testified in Oakland yesterday. I think that is worth noting. Remember that during the hypno-programming of Candy Jones, we saw some material in which Candy Jones stated that blacks were taking over and that you could see it all around her. This material had been drilled into her by Jensen and Marshall Berger. There was another very interesting point that was brought up in this article. A little later, it says, Cromer also talked about eating a healthy heart, unquote, as a cure for heart disease. I think the phrase here, eating a healthy heart, is interesting. You'll recall that in Buffalo, New York, there has been a plague of racial murders in recent months, and several of the victims had their hearts cut out, and later, animal hearts were left at several spots in the city that were frequented by blacks. I'd encourage you to keep an eye out for this sort of heart's pathology in connection with racial murder. If it continues to crop up, it may indicate that there is indeed a method to this madness. Well, still another fascinating article about the Darlin June Cromer case appeared in the San Francisco Examiner on Tuesday, January 27th of 1981. In this article, Darlin June Cromer stated that powerful people, unquote, shared her view that blacks were subhuman. She also stated that she kept this to herself because she didn't trust the uninformed masses, unquote. As you listen to this, bear in mind Candy Jones' racist indoctrination at the hands of powerful people from the CIA, as well as her control agent Jensen's repeated warnings that she should avoid people and keep her views to herself because she would be misunderstood. And eventually, of course, Jensen actually programmed her to act accordingly. The following story appeared in the San Francisco Examiner on Tuesday, January 27th of 1981. It's an Examiner story, once again, by Don Martinez, and it's entitled, Alameda Child Killer's Strange Special Knowledge, unquote. And I'm not going to read all of this article, but just the first couple of paragraphs. It reads, Donna June Cromer thought she had a special knowledge, unquote, when she killed a 5-year-old black Alameda boy last February 5th, according to a defense psychiatrist. The 34-year-old Pinot woman, convicted last week of first-degree murder in the strangulation of Reginald Williams, believed that powerful people, unquote, shared her view of black people, that they were less than human and meant to be eaten by white people like chickens and cows, unquote. The reason she attempted to avoid detection during the brutal crime, according to the psychiatrist yesterday in the sanity phase of her Oakland trial, was that Cromer distrusted the uninformed masses, unquote, who didn't share her opinion. The preceding story was not the only case in which powerful people, unquote, were mentioned in connection with the Cromer trial. Perhaps the most interesting of all the stories that appeared in connection with the Cromer case concerned a former boyfriend of Ms. Cromer's who claimed to have been a very high-ranking U.S. and British intelligence agent and paid assassin. The man in question was named Ron McGinnis, and McGinnis claimed to have been hired by the Nixon White House to murder mafia heroin traffickers. I think this is well worth noting because of the Nixon administration's, because the Nixon administration's hiring of ex-CIA personnel to work as drug enforcement agency assassins against organized crime drug pins has, well, it's been documented beyond dispute by a wide variety of sources. This is a subject we'll be getting into in some detail in the future on Hard Rain. Gonna read you this story here for just a second. This story, once again, is from the San Francisco Examiner on Thursday, January 8th, 1981. It's also an Examiner story by Don Martinez, and it's entitled, Witness Tells Bizarre Story That Cromer's Jury Doesn't Hear. A former boyfriend of Darlin June Cromer freely talks about being committed to 3 mental institutions and claims to have served as a special aide to Presidents Nixon and Ford and to killing 4,047 people in the cloak and dagger world of, among other things, an FBI investigator. However, Ron McGinnis never got a chance yesterday to tell his bizarre tale to an Oakland jury in Cromer's murder trial because the prosecutor thought better, unquote, of calling him as a rebuttal witness. McGinnis, wearing a fur-lined flight jacket in which he carries a plastic flask of water, testified outside the presence of the jury during a hearing to determine his competency as a witness. Alameda County Superior Judge Wilmot Sweeney eventually ruled that the man was indeed competent to testify, but Assistant District Attorney Albert Mullaling decided against putting McGinnis on the stand, putting McGinnis on the witness stand before the jury. The prosecutor told reporters outside of court that he thought better, unquote, about calling McGinnis as a witness. The prosecutor's original purpose was to question McGinnis about seeing Cromer on the morning of last February 5th, the day the Pinot woman is accused of killing 5-year-old Reginald Williams. When the jury excused from the courtroom, McGinnis freely discussed his history of psychiatric problems, plus what he has said was a varied and violent career as an aide to 2 U.S. presidents, a top general's aide in the Army, a nuclear weapons expert called upon to disarm and arm atomic bombs, a special FBI investigator who was licensed to kill and maim, unquote, a member of Her Majesty's Secret Service, unquote, in which he was only licensed to kill. He also said that as an aide to President Nixon, he banked $13 million with the president for investment purposes, but couldn't collect the vast fortune for at least 2 years. Meanwhile, McGinnis said he is living on monthly Social Security checks and residing in a small San Francisco hotel. Elaborating on some of his alleged exploits as a Nixon aide, McGinnis said he was part of a special secret task force handpicked by the president to wage war on the Italian mafia, unquote, on the Italian mafia-controlled drug market in an uncontrolled, in an undisclosed state. Excuse me. We didn't contact the governor or federal drug officials, McGinnis said, but we netted billions of dollars in narcotics. Ever since, McGinnis said, he's been hunted by mafia hitmen. On one occasion, the witness said he was wounded by an assailant who was armed with a double-barreled shotgun. He said he has taken the lives of 4,047 persons who have tried to kill him. However, President Ford told me that if anybody ever asked, I should tell him that I only killed 300, McGinnis continued. He said he was committed to 3 separate mental institutions over the past 13 years because of bad trips, unquote, on LSD and other drugs. Midway through his testimony, McGinnis reached into his jacket and took a drink of water from his flask. He smiled at Cromer, who attempted to chat with McGinnis during a court recess. However, bailiffs quickly ended the attempted tete-a-tete. McGinnis said he thought of himself as sane at this point in my life. He told the prosecutor that he remembered and could truthfully testify about the last time he saw Cromer on the morning of the day the Williams boy was killed. However, Mullaling produced another witness after the recess, and McGinnis never reappeared in court. The other witness, San Francisco probation officer Margaret Evans said Cromer was assigned to her after a 1977 incident in which Cromer assaulted a Chinese woman in the city. It was Evans' view that Cromer was not mentally disturbed, but more resembled the profile of one who is criminally oriented, unquote. Well, this story is very important for a number of reasons. As I say, the fact that the Nixon White House had hired former CIA personnel to act as assassins for the Drug Enforcement Agency against the kingpins of the international narcotics trade has been very well documented. We're going to talk about that in future Hard Rain programs. The McGinnis story does seem to be a little exaggerated in some respects. He claimed to have killed 4,047 people, although he says President Ford only told him to say it was only 300. The figure 4,047 sounds very high to me, although I must say, never having been a hitman, I'm really not in a position to comment authoritatively on that. It seems to me there are three possibilities here. One may be that McGinnis' story is true. Perhaps it is a fabrication, that there's no truth at all to it. Still another possibility is that McGinnis was subjected to some kind of mind control, and that basically his story is based on fact, but that due to the effects of brainwashing, it is distorted. Keep all three possibilities in mind. I think it is also important to note that the prosecutor thought better about calling McGinnis, and the jury never heard the story. It's not specified why he thought better, and I think it's also important to note that McGinnis said McGinnis and Cromer were prevented from communicating in the courtroom. You'll recall that they began to converse and that their conversation was broken up by the bailiffs. That basically concludes our look at the Darlin June Cromer case. I would say that the woman, Darlin June Cromer, is undoubtedly disturbed. The question in my mind is, was her psychosis natural, or was it something that was somehow experimentally induced in her? That is something that I think is food for thought and grounds for further research. Something which is also food for thought and grounds for further research here is the fact that Candy Jones had been hypnoprogrammed by Gilbert Jensen in Oakland, California.